This is Franz Amason. Welcome back to Travel Trade Exchange. It's been a long time since I put out the second part of this episode with Bill Wiebe. I've been tied up. I've been traveling a lot, and I have not had any contributions from any of you listeners, so I don't know if there's anybody out there that even listens. And when I mean on contributions, I mean I want your stories. I don't want your money. I just want your stories, and I want to share them with the other listeners to this podcast. So I had this idea that people would want to talk about their travel stories, and so far I have been proven incorrect in that assumption. So this podcast may die if we don't start getting other stories, and I'm hoping other people will start calling in and or sending in their stories of their travel experiences. With that, I'm going to get on to the second portion of the interview I had with my friend Bill, which was recorded months ago, but I just have not had time to edit it and get it out here. So here we go. Now, years ago, you told me a story when you were in Santiago, Chile, I think, and you were pickpocketed in Santiago, right?
Oh, no. Oh, that's the other time. Yeah. They keep saying I haven't had much trouble, but I guess I have. I was in Peru once. A place in Arequipa is what it was, in the southern part of Peru. A beautiful place, has a lovely volcano called El Misti that peers down over the city from the east. Just a beautiful mountain, beautiful volcano that rises from the city, which is quite low, but the volcano is 14,000 feet high, so there's this. It's a nice setting. But that place had some good pickpockets too, and I got pickpocketed there by a group. There was a couple of guys in a white car, and this poor guy that did the deed, the white car drove by, and they whistled at me or yelled at me to where I turned to the right, to the street, and that exposed my pocket. And this guy reached into my pocket, grabbed the wallet, and started running down the road as quickly as he could go. So it was two or three guys that did this, but I was young and kind of mad at the time, so I chased him, and I dropped my backpack and my... I just went running down the road after this guy, and he took my wallet and started throwing stuff out of it, the credit cards and some a little bit of money. He saved $100, $100 bill. So my wallet was being strewn all over the road, but I kept after him, and I caught him. I backed him into a corner. He gave me my last $100, and my partner was picking up the pieces as I had caught this guy, and we're kind of at this standoff where he's looking at me and we're both breathing pretty hard. And it wasn't a mean thing. It was like we were kind of actually almost smiling at each other. And then he gave me my $100 and he took off. And he ran out of this other alley, and I didn't follow him any further than that. So my wife, she's kind of an athlete, and she doesn't think I can run. I was older. I was probably 40 at the time, and she kind of looks at me and says, "You caught him, huh? You caught that young guy?" And I said, "Yeah, I did. I caught him." And she said, "Yeah, I bet he was a smoker." But I don't recommend that. That was one of the stupidest things I've done in a long time. That guy could have had a knife or a gun, or the partner could have come back, and I'd have been on the street in a pool of blood because of a wallet with $100 in it. So it's better to have something for these guys, and just figure it's a cost of traveling. So that's a different place. So that was Peru, and I think that's not as safe as Quito was.
So you've traveled around South America. You've been to Brazil, Venezuela. Have you been to Colombia?
No, I've skipped that so far, but I'd like to go there. I hear it settling down a little bit. The thing that worries me about, well, Colombia in particular, but Mexico has some of this problem, and Guatemala is where they'll kidnap you. They'll take you hostage. It's more a problem for big corporations where they lose their executives, and they have to ransom their executives to a lot of money. So I never went to Colombia because there's people there. There's example of folks that have spent years as hostages to the FARC, to the kind of the cocaine guerrilla movement out in the jungles of Colombia. That that fight has kind of settled down a little bit. I don't think it's gone, but I don't know. I don't know. I didn't go to. We skipped Colombia on the road trip that we took, and we've never really gone in there.
The road trip you took. So you've been back to Ecuador three times now?
Yeah,
four times?
We were down for a while there. We were going down to South America one place or another pretty much every year. This road trip that I got into this last time we talked, where I talked about taking
the boat down
Subaru. Yeah, we took the Subaru. We put it on a ferry boat in Manaus, and the ferry went down to... It was a Brazilian state or government ferry, and it went down to Belém. That's kind of where we quit that trip. I quit talking about that trip at Belém, but I highly recommend that trip. The trip down the Amazon, either on the ferry or one of the local, they have some private boats that go down. That's a good way to see the Amazon. It's not a cruise ship, but it's an experience that you'll not soon forget. It's really something. So, I don't know. For a while we had this... Go ahead.
Yeah.
For a while we had this car. I ended up with this car down there. We drove it the length of Brazil from Belém. The road starts again in Belém, and you can take a paved road from Belém clear to, I think you can go all the way to the tip of South America now on paved roads from Belém, but you can't go from the middle of the Amazon jungle at Manaus. You can't go across the jungle to get Belém by road. You have to go on a boat or fly, I guess. But we got the car to Belém and then took that the rest of the way to, we took it to Argentina, to Mendoza. That was an earlier trip than the Ecuador deal. And then I drove it, not with my wife, but I drove it down the eastern slope of the Andes. We went to I went to Punta Arenas with one friend or another. We went down to the tip of South America with this car. So what would happen is during the fishing season, the first time we went, we were probably gone for 3 months or 4 months. And then after that, that was the year 2000. We were probably gone 4 months. Then after that, I'd come back once a year and just do some more traveling down one part of the South American
continent. Pick up the car and move on from there,
yeah,
then, huh?
And store it during the off season. I always had great luck. I could always find somebody to some yard or something to store it in and leave it parked and come back. And I didn't have any trouble coming back and not finding my car, which you'd think that would happen, but with a little bit of interviewing and checking around, you could usually find an honest person or some kind of business that wasn't going away, and they would be willing to store the car for a few $100. It usually wasn't too much.
So do you think you're pretty fluent in Spanish now?
It comes and goes. It depends on what. Once I get there, I can get enough Spanish to travel with, to find something to eat, to get to the next town, sort of the simple conversational stuff. But 50 years old is not the time to really learn another language. So if you have kids, gosh, I highly recommend getting them out to some foreign country while they're in high school or junior high. Foreign exchange is a great program with this, I forget the name of the outfits that do it, but you can place your child in a family in Europe or South America or Japan, and that's the best way to learn a language. When you're 50 is not the best time to start. I think they say that if you're going to be fluent, you better learn it when you're an early teenager or something like that.
Now, did you listen to any courses or just learn as you went?
Mostly I just take what I call a course. I go out and buy something or get in a conversational type of stuff. So I've only taken a few formal, with a teacher, a few formal classes of Spanish. I did have this little red verb book. Comes down to the verbs, really. Lots of memorization of verbs. And I'd had that book in my back pocket. I also had a dictionary, one of those little speaking dictionaries that came out 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was the newest, latest thing for about a year. But you could type a word into it, and then it would tell you the Spanish pronunciation.
Oh, it's an electronic gadget then.
An electronic translator, dictionary type of thing. So I used that. I used my little verb book, which was very valuable. And you could get all the forms of these Spanish verbs, which are very, they have a certain rules. They have certain rules to
them. I went, you went, we went.
I went, you went, we are.
Yeah.
So you just have all these different forms of verbs. Once you use that, as you memorize that, you can kind of get the point across. Where I fall down on Spanish is when the topic leaves just the usual everyday type of stuff. If I try to talk politics or any kind of technical stuff, then it doesn't work very well. And I get a lot better when I've been there for a few months. Then I get better and better and better at it. As soon as I come back to Alaska, I just don't speak it, and I lose the fluency pretty quickly. So
now, have you had on the trip when you left Brazil, or when you went through Brazil and down in your travels? Do you have any particular any specific stories that you remember that come to your mind? Any good anecdotes that you you think about any time? I mean, they don't have to be whole stories.
No,
I mean,
but just like quick little vignettes or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me think about that. And it's just specifically relating to South America or...
No, you know, it doesn't have to be South America. Because, you know, I started you... You spent a lot of time in North Africa, too.
Well, a little bit. My dad took us down there when we were on this sabbatical... Don't really recall. Spent some time in South Africa.
Hold on. When you left Utah in 1971, didn't you go to North Africa? Didn't you fly to Morocco?
Oh, I did. Yeah. That was the first trip after the European thing. A friend of mine, we'd been in college for a year, and we were tired of it, so we quit college. And we flew to Morocco. And spent a month and a half in Morocco. And then I traveled north through Spain and France with various travel partners, just people I'd meet. Sometimes I'd meet them, and then we'd just travel for a few days and then meet them again. Travel with a girl there for a while. We went from a British girl. We went from Switzerland to her house in London. So that was kind of a nice, we were hitchhiking. I don't know what we're thinking, but we wouldn't even pay money for a bus fare. So both of us were just living on nothing, staying in youth hostels, that kind of thing.
Now, did you have to worry? Now, that was right at the tail end of the Vietnam War.
Right.
What was your number? I mean, that was back when we had numbers.
I know. I won that lottery. That I got the highest number. I got 366, and there was no way that I was going to Vietnam, but there were other people at my age.
So that wasn't a worry for you. And I was 340, so I was the same thing. I was not going to Vietnam.
No,
so.
It was a lucky break, because if you had number one or, I don't know, my year, what year did they take, you know, 1 through 70 or something? I don't know.
I think you're the same age as I am.
I am, but it depended on you were born in 52 or
53?
Yeah, so you would have been a different year.
Okay.
Yeah. But 52, November 1st in 52 was the 300, was the best number you could get. So I didn't have to go that direction, but this friend of mine, Mike LeBrun, and I, we went to Morocco for a while. But it was sort of pretty much college kids, backpacker type of travel. I don't remember anything that really stands out for particularly interesting. This point,
let me change directions here. So, sure. Bill, you've had a pretty interesting life.
I don't know. It's a, I don't know. You can.
I mean,
I've been a life of traveling a lot, but not as far as really doing anything with my life. As far as taking and making a difference, that's one thing I kind of fall short of. I've had a good life, an easy life, and I've done a lot of things, but as far as contributing or making a pile of money, I really really haven't done much there. It would have been nice to, you know, write a book and patent something or be part of building a new bridge or building or something like that. But.
Well, you're leaving something behind now, Bill. You're leaving stories behind.
I guess I am.
That's good. But you started, this is always a good story, because your father was an academician, and you had a good education. You and I both went to the same grade school together up in Logan,
That's
Utah.
Right.
So we go back a long ways. But You had a great education, and then you ended up becoming an Alaska fisherman.
Yeah, that was kind of a wild deal for a guy from Utah.
Yeah.
I suppose that was about traveling there, too, to begin with. That was a... Definitely was.
You were looking for adventure.
Looking for a new place. I was kind of like you, you know, just a bit ready to leave Logan, Utah when we got out of high school. It seemed like, well, it's common, I think. I think a lot of high school kids, when they're out of, it's like the sky's the limit and they want to go someplace else. And that was certainly the way I felt about Logan, Utah. I figured that every place else had to have better skiing, better swimming, more trees, greener pastures kind of thing. I started... Went to college in Oregon, and then this Alaska thing started off as a summer job. I was a ski bum back here in Logan for one reason, back here in Alda for one reason or another. And the snow all melted, and I wasn't making any money. And a friend of mine came through in a truck, and he was a fisherman from Kodiak, Alaska, actually. And so I hitchhiked up with him. It was a free ride up to Alaska, or pay for gas and go to Alaska. And we drove all the way to Kodiak in 1977, I guess it was.
You can't drive to Kodiak, Bill.
Well, you can drive to Homer, where I live now, and then you can take a ferry. Okay. Good point, Franz. Your geography is right up there. Yeah. So you can drive to Homer from there, from your front door in the lower 48. You can drive right to my house on a paved road. Back then, it wasn't. We drove up in a VW Bug. It was a horrible car, and it lost its alternator, or generator, I guess is what it was. Lost that 1,500 miles away from the destination in Kodiak. So we had a little problem, and the way we resolved this problem is we charge the battery every night at a filling station and camp out next to the filling station. Then you could have enough juice to start the car the next morning and run the car all day before the battery would be dead again.
But you couldn't drive at night because you had
no lights.
You
couldn't drive at night. You couldn't turn the windshield wipers on.
You couldn't listen to the radio.
You couldn't listen to the radio. But you could run the ignition, and really you couldn't really shut the car down either. You sort of had to leave it. What we'd do is we'd park it on a hill so you could restart the thing. But... we got there one way or another, and for one reason or another, this sort of escapes me, but this guy that picked me up, my friend from Kodiak, was a surprisingly wealthy man. He is a wealthy man now, and even then, I didn't realize that he'd had a lot of good fishing seasons, and there was no reason for him to be driving a beat-up VW to Alaska, except that he was, he just didn't want to spend his money on a new car. So
that's how he got rich, Bill.
I guess it is. It's if that's how they do that. So John Mitchell got me to Kodiak and kind of pointed me in the right direction and which boats to. I needed a job, so I wanted to get a job on a fishing boat up there. And it was quite competitive at the time. There were a lot of college students that would come up, and you could make a few $1,000s a year, a summer, fishing up there. And at that time, that was a lot of money. So I figured I could probably do the same thing. And I finally got a job with a Mormon, with an LDS guy that had uncles and, well, he had relatives that lived a block away from me in Logan when I was growing up.
Really?
Okay. You remember the Wadsworth house that was
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Ray Wadsworth is the guy I worked for up in Alaska.
Oh, okay.
There's quite a family of them. There were some of them in Oakley, Idaho, and a bunch of them there at the university. And Ray hired me on his fishing boat. And I immediately was sold on that whole idea. I liked the idea of seasonal work. I got seasick, so I didn't really like the actual traveling on the boat. But I liked fishing. I thought fishing was just fine. So we ended up... fished with him for a few years, and then eventually got my own boat with Ray.
Well, you didn't get your own boat. You built your own boat.
That's right. Well, let's see how that goes. So 2 years into it, Ray, who is a talented man. He's been rich and broke and rich and broke. He's so broke, the last time he went broke that he moved to Oakley, Idaho, and bought a house off the courthouse steps for, I think, $7,000. The town was almost a ghost town a few years ago. So he moved away from the ocean, and he was not going to fish ever again. He's come back from that, and he's back up in Alaska right now. But he's that kind of guy, sort of a you see a lot of that in the fishing business, just gamblers, guys that'll be very wealthy one day, and they spend it all, and a typical fisherman deal, they'll get a lot of money, and they buy it on a new boat or go into debt, and then they're broke the next 2 years later. So Ray and I got a job with Ray, and then 2 years into that, I'm fishing on deck with Ray. He decided that he wanted to build a new boat, and he was going to build it right from scratch, right from the lines that he had drawn the previous winter. So there was this sketch, kind of a scroll, really. It was like 2 feet long, because in his view, the only scale that you could use was 1 inch equals 1 foot. So this drawing was 47 inches long, and the boat ended up being 47 feet long. And he and I took this this plan, and we lofted the boat out and cut the stations on it. I guess it would be it wasn't ribbed because we were making a plug for the fiberglass boat. So I helped him for that winter building the first fiberglass boat out of his shop. And that was, and I went back fishing for him. And the year after that, then we built another boat that was a partnership affair with Ray and me. So I was a partner with Ray for 7 years, and he's a great guy and a guy that can visualize things, like just an amazingly talented guy, but he's not very good at managing money. And so I was a partner with him for 7 years. We parted on good terms, and he went on to do much more, you know, boats and jet skiffs and all kinds of technological stuff. That was what he loved to do. I viewed fishing more as a way to make an income and a seasonal job that would end at some point and I could do something else. I always thought I was going to get a real job someplace, but I never did. So.
Now, when you first moved to Alaska, you built a yurt to live in.
Yeah, that was luckily enough. I was fishing for, let's see, I guess it was 2 or 3 years. So I was living a very bachelor sort of lifestyle in Alaska. Fishing was mostly guys. There were a few women getting on the boats. There were some women in the bars in Kodiak that were pretty wild, but I was pretty much a single guy. We actually named the boat Namorada, which is, I hear it is, it's a Portuguese for girlfriend. So I had this girlfriend, but it was a boat, so it was a bad deal. What I ended up doing is coming back during the off season, and I met my wife in Logan, Utah during the ski season. So she and I wanted to move to Alaska, and Kodiak was a little too rough. I didn't like it. It was pretty much concentrated on fishing. So we decided to move to Homer, and we had no house. And we decided that we were going to live in a yurt. I don't know why, but she decided that a yurt would be a cool thing. And I like the geometry of the whole structure. It's kind of a very Spartan or a sparsely, you know, there's not a lot of wood in it, and they're very strong. There's something that was invented on the Mongolian, you know, in Eastern Asia, up in the steppes up there. And they're a very strong structure. So we built one in the back of my mom's yard in Logan, at least the frame for it. And we used your sewing machine.
That's
Remember
right.
that?
That's right.
We had a sewing machine that could sew two needles at one time.
Double stitch machine. Yeah.
Double stitch machine. We borrowed that, and we used that to sew the cover for that yurt a long time ago. I don't think we ever managed to put the yurt cover on the frame in Logan, but we had it made, and we took a truck with a trailer dragging all of our earthly possessions up to Homer in 1980, I don't know, 85 or something like that was when we went up, 80, 87 was when we went up. So we unpacked this truck and put up a yurt, and that's what we lived in for, well, most of the winter that year. Alaska used to have this sort of romance attached to it where you'd live the life of a sourdough in a little cabin, and you'd go off the road system, and you wouldn't come back for 6 months. That was it. You're just going to live the life of a pioneer. Well, that has pretty much gone by the wayside. There's some people that live up there all the time, but most Alaskans, I'd say almost all of them, figure out some reason to get out of there during the winter. So you might live in a cabin for a few months, but then you catch the mail plane and you go to Anchorage and fly to Mexico is a very good destination, as is Hawaii.
Anywhere sunny and warm.
Sunny and warm. There's flights out of Anchorage that leave in the middle of January, and it's a beautiful thing. You can get on those flights, and they're charter flights, and you can fly from Anchorage, and 4.5 hours later, you're in Honolulu, and you can just change your clothes on the flight. You don't have to take you don't need to take any bag, no bag fees. You just go there with the clothes on your back. It's really a wonderful thing after living in the dark and cold in Anchorage, very cold. And after Christmas, that happens quite frequently.
Well, see, the day we're doing this is January 18th, and you just got back from Costa Rica, right?
Yeah, I got back. We left just before Christmas. We spent a couple of weeks in Costa Rica, then back to Phoenix, where my wife's dad, where my father-in-law lives. I spent a few days there, and then we drove up to Logan here, where my mom lives. And I haven't been in any particular rush to get back to Homer, not yet. So
no winter, long winter trips you're planning this year then?
No, we're going to go back. We've got a river trip planned in March that it's probably going to come together. That's in the, down by Moab, it's in the Green River. And I'm not sure that one's going to get pulled off or not.
Which canyon is that?
It's in Canyonlands National Park.
Okay.
Yeah, the Green River there. It's pretty cool. I don't know.
What rapids are there? Is that the...
You know, the good trip, Franz, what you can do with a family is the Green. It's the old trip they used to have, something called the
French... Labyrinth Canyon?
Yeah,
down below Labyrinth Canyon. I did that on a canoe years ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it continues down. You go to the confluence. Did you go all the way to the confluence?
No, I got out at Mineral Basin, I think.
Yeah, Mineral Bottom.
Mineral Bottom, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we usually put in at Mineral Bottom and then float down to the confluence. There's a jet boat that'll
pick you up. So you can get out at the confluence now.
There's a jet boat these days. It'll come in and pick you up.
Okay.
That's just a good idea. Anybody that doesn't like whitewater should get out right there. And then there's 17 miles of whitewater down below the confluence until you get to Glen Canyon recreational area to the to Lake Powell.
Did you get a permit and go through all
that? Yeah, they're easy.
Oh, they really?
The cataract is easy. It's $25 and just name your date. So that's kind of nice yet. The most whitewater is pretty well regulated these days.
But now, is Labyrinth Canyon still regulated? Do you have to get a permit for that? When I did it, we did not have to have that.
No, Labyrinth isn't in the park. I think you could still jump in. Did you go? You must have gone down
just below, Bonnot, just below Green River, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to do that. I never have. Yeah.
It's really flat water, flat water.
It can be a beautiful thing, flat water. If you just, if you want to take somebody that's never been boating, that's a great trip. Yeah, in the Red Rock.
Yeah.
A lot to see there.
We camped out one or two nights on that trip because it was so slow. But it was a memorable trip. We were all by ourselves, nobody else at the same time. So
it's surprising how that hasn't caught on. You know, there's a lot of people that go down to Lake Powell, in the houseboat thing. But really, the rivers in Utah, there's a lot of very slow water that's actually very scenic. It's a good way to...
Have you ever done the Dolores River?
No, I'd like to. Have you?
No, friends of mine do it, and that's another slow river.
So. Slow, and it's it's real seasonal.
I shouldn't say that. I've done the Dolores where the white water is, but not the. I'm thinking I have done the Dolores below Dove Creek, Colorado.
Oh yeah.
And then did that a few years ago, well, quite a few years ago, I should say, probably 25 years ago. But what the one I'm thinking of is the San Juan?
San Juan,
the Dolores empties into the San Juan, right?
Actually, I think the Dolores comes in from Colorado, and it flows into the Colorado above Moab.
Okay.
The San Juan actually starts very near the Dolores, but then takes a different course. It ends up in New Mexico for a while, and then back into Utah, and it finally joins the Colorado way down in Lake Powell. So it's a different group. We did that one too.
You did do the San Juan then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, through the Comb Ridge, I think is what we did. Oh, I wish I could think of some better, just short snippets here, Franz. I haven't.
That's all right.
In mind.
But now I wanted to ask you, I wanted to go describe does the herring season still the way it used to be, the Wild West? Is it? I want you to describe what it's like in the herring season in Alaska. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of what I call sort of misinformation out there that, you know, the cod fishery on the East Coast, and you can name a whole bunch of fisheries, like the salmon fishery in California, and they're basically toast. There's not much left of them. They've been fished out, and there's really no excuse. It's badly regulated. There were too many fishermen. They got too good at it, and they caught them all. But there are places in this world that that's not the case. There's places where there is still a lot of fish, where the resources are abundant. You see it at certain times of year where there are an amazing amount of salmon that come into a certain bays in Alaska. And same thing in May. There's just immense schools of herring that come in out of the deep, and they'll come in and spawn. The classic, the best, probably the biggest fishery is the Bristol Bay fishery at Togiak. And I've been participating in that for a number of years. It's remarkably well regulated, and it's in distinct contrast to a lot of fisheries across the planet. It's so well regulated that there's been seasons where we've been allowed 20 minutes to fish. So that's you take your boat, you go all the way to Bristol Bay, you set it all up. They pick the exact moment they want to catch these fish, and they give all the boats 20 minutes to fish. That's it. And then maybe one boat out of 10 scores, but everybody goes home. So you can spend all this time, you get one crack at it, and then that's it. That's not the state of affairs on most of the East Coast fisheries. It's certainly not the case in the Gulf. They're doing a little better with some of the Northwest salmon fisheries. And I'd say that the Alaska halibut fishery has been managed very well. Also salmon pretty well too, and this herring fishery. But so maybe there's not a lot of fisheries that are abundant, but they're still out there, and it's not something that kind of going on here, but it's not something that you really think that every fish has been caught in the ocean. There's still places where this resources are quite strong, and I think they'll stay that way if we are careful about it. So I was going to tell you about these sets, these herring sets. We have, our boat is what's called a purse seiner, and we have a net that's 600 feet long. That would be the maximum legal length of this net is 600 feet. It's about 90 feet deep, and it sits on the back of our boat in a big pile. And we have a little boat called the skiff that hangs on to the what we call the money bag, which is on the top of the pile. So what we do is we have for this particular fishery, what we'll see is when our turn comes around, when they finally open the season up, most times we get maybe half a dozen openings that might amount to a couple hours of fishing. So that was, it's pretty much of a crapshoot, but it is not something that you go out there and just fish as you like till you get tired of fishing. You fish when the fishing game tells you that you're allowed to fish, and if you break the rules, the penalties can be pretty severe. They take your boat, and they'll... It's quite a large fine if you get caught, and you will get caught. So when these fish come in, they won't be there for 11 months of the year, and all of a sudden they pick their day to come in to the coast of Bristol Bay, and they come in, it's like a polka dot ocean. It's an amazing migration of fish that come in. They'll come in, and as they get ready to spawn, they'll move up onto the rocks and onto the beaches. They typically start spawning, but there'll be this white cloud of spawn that comes out of the male fish, and then the females lay their eggs in the middle of that. The fishermen's idea is to catch these fish just before they spawn, because the Japanese like herring that are full of eggs, and they'll pay, it's like caviar for them, and they'll pay top dollar for these fish. So these schools, they'll be like a polka dot ocean, and then they sort of assemble into these vast schools of fish. Maybe, there's been sightings of schools that are a couple of miles long. They'll have these schools that are covering 60 miles of a coastline of Bristol Bay, and you might see 100,000 tons of fish. The Fish and Game estimates that they can see this when their biologists fly over and they start counting these schools, and they have sort of a rough estimate of what they have. So it's a pretty impressive sight when they all come in. It's just a few days a year, but it's been pretty consistently every year since they started fishing that stock in 1975. So our idea is we get our chance, and it's a very, very competitive deal. We know that we get maybe they'll tell us that the season's going to start at 12 noon. So everybody is driving their boats around looking for a school of fish, and it's very stressful. We look from the rigging, and we also have spotter pilots, airplanes, that will look around and tell us where to go. They'll guide the boats from the air. So this gets pretty intense sometimes. We've had as many as 350 boats out there, 370 boats, I think, and everybody wants their crack at these fish. So there's a lot of jockeying going on, a little bit of boat ramming. And when the time comes, then we're allowed to make one set. We can take this net I was telling you about. The skiff is cut loose from the boat. It pulls the money bag in the water, and we make a circle around the fish. And you can see this as sort of like cutting a hole out of a donut. This is a 600-foot long net, but we don't go around the school. We take a chunk out of the school. So it's just like you take a piece out of this school. And the biggest set I've ever had was 450 tons of fish in this
one set.
So you wake up in the morning, you're poor, you can go out and make this one set, and if you're lucky, then you can get paid for this set. You have to pump it out. You're done fishing after the ends of the fish of the net it's together, and after that you can spend the next day or so dealing with all of this fish that you have in your
net. So the net surrounds it, and then it's called a purse seine. So then you pull in the string at the bottom to close up the bottom of the net?
Yeah.
So
it's a lot like a lady's purse. Okay. So you end up with the bottom of the net has some bridles on it. These bridles have a ring on each bridle, and then the purse line goes through those rings, and as you pull the purse line in, it puckers the net up underneath the fish. So the last place that they can escape is by diving out. They typically, for some reason, they don't do that. And in Togiak, the water is so shallow that your net is on the bottom.
Oh, so you don't need to even take the purse in then?
Well, you purse it in because you can't get the net. You can't get the fish out of the net unless you pull. You have to call it what's called drying it up.
Okay.
So you pull most of the net back aboard until the fish are concentrated in the money bag. And basically the water is gone. All you've got is fish left. And then you pump them out of the net into a series of tenders. If you're lucky, you could load two or three tenders with the one set of fish.
So you been consistently lucky at this game?
No. I wish I was consistently lucky. If I could figure that out, then that would be an easy life. I wouldn't have to do anything else except go to Togiak one time every year, catch a whole pile of fish, and come home. It'd be a beautiful thing. But it doesn't work that way. It's a job wrapped up with a riverboat gamble. So you can imagine anything goes wrong. You can get somebody can bump into you, so you're out of commission when the season starts, or somebody will run over your net, or maybe you're lucky enough to get the ends together and the fish back out of your net and you don't have anything in your net, or maybe the fish actually get in your net and you start pursing on this thing and you might have rocks and then the net doesn't purse. And pretty soon it's all just totally messed up. The fish escape by one way or another. They'll usually swim out underneath the boat and you don't have anything that way. Other times, then you get even a little more lucky and maybe you get the purse line up and you start drying up the net and you're just sort of counting your, you're just counting your money. It's a good thing. Pretty soon all the fish are all concentrated in one part of the net. It's a beautiful thing. You call the tender in. The tender's going to come in to pump the net out, and he gets his propeller caught in your net. And then, in a matter of 4 or 5 minutes, all the fish that you have gathered up will swim out through the hole, and you'll be poor again. So you're right back to square one. So you can lose your fish. You can lose your fish any number of ways. Say you get lucky. You get the pump alongside. The pump works. It pumps out the fish. It fills up the tender. And you think, well, now we're in them. We just got to wait for the check to come. And then that doesn't happen. There's a lot of examples of the fish getting ruined or the company not paying you. And you really don't have any money for fishing herring until you have a check and you've cashed it and put it in the bank. All sorts of things go wrong earlier than that. They usually do. There's just so many ways of losing your season, and the only option at that point is to go back and come back next year. It's not like there's a lot of second chances in this deal.
From Homer, how far do you have to take your boat up?
Well, I've been keeping the boat in Bristol Bay. We have some other things going on that are a little less of a gamble. We do some tendering out in Bristol Bay, so I keep the boat out there.
Okay.
But if you're running all the way from Homer to Bristol Bay, and I've done this, it's probably 10 days of running every day for maybe 20 hours a day. For us, we can never, it'd be less time than that. But what happens is running from Homer down the Pacific side of the Aleutian Peninsula and then coming back on the Bering Sea side, there's a lot of bad weather, so we'll spend a lot of time anchored up behind some island or something. And so it's usually a couple of weeks to get the thing out there. It's kind of an adventure the first time you do it. After you do it, as many times as I have, I don't want to do it anymore. I'd like to relocate to the Pacific side and not work in Bristol Bay at this point. I've got a house in Homer, so the idea of moving to Bristol Bay every year would be better if I could figure out some way to You probably wouldn't make as much money, but it might be a better lifestyle to have the boat on the Homer side of things. So, yeah.
So, Bill, where haven't you been that you want to go now?
Where else would be cool to go? I'd like to go back to Europe, but I had this. I like road trips, so we did this South America car trip. I wouldn't mind doing the same thing across Asia. You know, you could. Yeah, Amsterdam is supposed to be a good place to buy a used car. So you could buy a car in Amsterdam and then run it east, you know, Amsterdam to Tajikistan or some darn thing. Just go east across southern Russia through these old cities on the Silk Road to China, the Bukhara and Samarkand and Tashkent, and all these places have sort of an appeal to me, maybe because I never been there. I just see pictures of these sort of spires, you know, Muslim cities in southern Russia. It's a little dangerous right now because of all this stuff going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but it'd be pretty cool. It'd be something that very mountainous as you go east. That's one thing that's on the list, to be a road trip that way. I'd like to do St. Petersburg. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
But I think that's more of a history thing and probably be more mainstream, go there with somebody that knew something about the place, a guide, and yeah. Some more of a city, so probably staying in hotels.
You know, I met some Dutch people a few years ago, and I kept my boat in Ivalik, Turkey.
Oh, yeah.
And two different Dutch couples had got on the Dutch canals, got up the Rhine, went all the way over on canals, got under the Danube, and went all the way to the Danube into the Black Sea, down through the Bosphorus, and then through the Sea of Marmara, and in through the Straits of Dardanelles, and right around to the corner where I was keeping my boat.
Cool.
Yeah.
So they could you get your boat up the Danube?
You could. You'd be fighting the current going up the Danube. But, yeah, I could.
Your boat has a centerboard, so you could lift it up.
No, it's a five-foot draft, and I think you can do it with a five-foot draft.
Yeah, I bet you could.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be a great trip. Yeah. Yeah. And the canals, I guess there's canals across there. And
you can go all the way from, the Baltic, Amsterdam, all the way up and over and down the Danube.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. No, that'd be a great trip. There's some rivers. Danube would be a beautiful one to try. Something with a little interest to it, some traffic, barges, or some commercial run. That'd be very interesting. The Danube would be that'd be a very good one. There's some old city,
all along the Danube.
Cities all the way along.
It was a trade. I mean, there was a trading river. That was what it was for. It was for moving freight up and down the river. So
yeah, where's your boat?
It's in Kresk, Croatia, right now.
Oh yeah. Great. Yeah.
Okay, that wraps up that interview with Bill. Went a little longer than I like to go. I usually like to limit them to about a half an hour, but I didn't want to break that interview up any farther. Hope you enjoyed it. And again, please, if you want to see this podcast continue, we need to get some of your stories, because I'm sure you've got some great stories to tell. With that, thank you very much. This is Franz. Goodbye.